Only a few days ago, this Jaghat here bit off the face of a Forkrel assail. She edged a step back to take in the Barghast. Do not clash those blades, warrior. They will shatter. Falash said,
Mother, we have found a new ally in our endeavours. The king of the Hold of Ice now stands with us.
Why? The other woman said, I don't think they like the Forkrel assail, Highness.
You must be Captain Shurk Elal, the queen said. I have heard interesting things about you, but that will have to wait until another time. 14th daughter, are you once again upon the seas?
We are, on a ship of the dead.
You think you're cold?
One hand fluttered.
We're less than 2 weeks from the teeth.
What of the Perish fleet? Falash shook her head.
No sign. We must assume they have arrived, whether a blockade now exists.
She shrugged.
Mother, be careful. The Forkrel assail know we are coming, all of us. They know.
Can we maintain this line of communication?
Not much longer, Falash replied. Once we draw closer to the assail's domain, their hold will dominate.
Spack snorted.
Even against the king of the Hold of Ice? Now, how pathetic is that?
The Jaghut faced him once more.
When Draconis stepped onto this world, he missed a few of your kind underfoot. He has grown careless in his old age. When next you and I meet, Barghast, we shall have words on the matter.
Have you a name, Jaghut?
Spax asked.
I want to know who to cuss. I want the name of this miserable, rotting carcass I'm looking at right now.
The mouth stretched once more.
Can you not guess, Barghast, as you squat shivering in my breath?
Falash said,
Mother, are you sure you want to go on with this? Against the forces now gathering, we're nothing.
I think, said Abrustle, the time has come to be more forthright regarding our allies here in the Wastelands. We seem to have acquired a force of, well, lizards. Large, powerful, well-armed. They call themselves the Kachain Chimal, and they are commanded by two Malazans. She stopped then, since the Jaghut had begun laughing. The sound reached into Spax's bones until he felt them rattling like frozen sticks. His glare, fixed upon the Jaghut, suddenly widened.
His breath? But how? No, yes. See that cloak, see that cowl.
He straightened, chest swelling.
I have never feared you, he said.
Hood ceased laughing, regarded the Barghast.
Of course not, War Chief Spax of the Gilk. But then, once I am known to you, fear is irrelevant, isn't it?
Especially when you're already dead.
One long bony finger lifted into view, wagged at the War Chief.
Ah, but how would you know? Imagine dying and then finding yourself asking, what now? The day you stand on the wrong side of death, Spax, come and find me. And in the bitter truth of equals, you and I shall discuss real fear.
Hood laughed a second time. Moments later, all three apparitions were gone. The biting chill remained, mists roiling in the chamber. Queen Abrustle fixed Spax with a hard stare.
What was all that about, War Chief?
He scowled.
I don't for an instant doubt that captain's claim. Bit off an assail's face, did he? I'm surprised it wasn't its whole damned head.
Spax fought off another shiver.
Too many swords in the fire, Highness. Things are going to break, badly.
Second thoughts?
More than I dare to count.
Breath gusted from his nostrils.
It's time to offer counsel, whether you like it or not.
I know you are committed to this venture, and nothing I can say will dissuade you. We're about to wage war against the Fokrul Azael.
He studied her with narrowed eyes.
You've wanted that for some time. I see the truth of that. But listen, there are times when a course decided upon gathers a power of its own. A momentum that sweeps us all along. Fireherr, this river we're on seems calm enough for now. But the current grows and grows, and soon, even if we seek the safety of shore, it will be too late.
A fine speech, Spex. The Gilk war chief advises caution. So noted. Abruptly she rose. My 14th daughter is not one you could tumble behind the equipment tent. That said, I do not think she invited that undead Jaghut into our alliance. Rather, I suspect she had little say in the matter.
And the current grows bold.
She eyed him. Journey to the Lethary camp. Inform Prince Bryce of this turn of events.
Now?
Now.
What of the parish?
The queen frowned and then shook her head. I will not see one of our few fit horses run to death just to bring word to the Grey Helms. I don't know what they're trying to prove with that torrid piece.
I do.
Indeed. Very well, Spex, let's hear it.
They seek to make us irrelevant, Fireherr. You, Bryce, and especially the Kachin Chemal.
They want the glory for themselves?
Shield and Viltanakalion,
he said, adding a disgusted grunt.
He's young, with too much to prove. But that is not what is bothering me, Highness. I no longer trust his motives. I cannot say if the goal he seeks is at all related to the adjuncts. These Grey Helms, they are the avatars of war. But it is not the war between peoples that they serve. It is the war of nature against humans.
Then he is a greater fool than we can even imagine, Abrustal said. He cannot win that war. Nature cannot win. It never could. Spax was silent for a moment, and then in a low voice he said,
I believe that it is the other way round, Highness. This is a war we cannot win. All of our victories are temporary, no, illusory. In the end, we lose, because even in winning, we still lose.
Abrustal walked from the chamber. Brows lifting, Spax followed her. Outside, under the green-lit night sky, passed the two guards. She continued down the center aisle between the officers' tents, out past the kitchen camps, the offal pits, the latrine rows.
Like peeling back the orderly facade, down now among the foul rubbish of our leavings. Ah, Fireherr. I am not so blind as to miss the meaning of this journey.
When at last she halted, they were beyond the northeast pickets. For Spax to make his way to the distant Lethary encampment, he need only strike out northward, angling slightly to the west. He could see the fitful glow from the prince's position.
Like us, they're running out of things to burn.
Abrastel faced east, to where just beyond a ribbon of white bones the glass desert was a sea of sharp, glittering stars, lying as if scattered in death, bathed in emerald light.
The wastelands, she murmured.
Highness?
Who won here, Spex?
As we can see, no one won.
And in the glass desert?
He squinted.
It hurts the eye, Fireherr. Blood was spilled there, I think. Immortal blood.
Would you throw the crime at the feet of humans?
He grunted.
Now you split reeds, Highness. It is the willful mind that is nature's enemy, for out of that willfulness comes arrogance
and contempt. Warchief, it seems we will all face a terrible choice then. Are we worth saving? You, me, my children, my people?
Do you now waver in your resolve?
She faced him. Do you? Spax scratched his beard with both hands.
All that Krughava said when she was ousted, I have considered it again and again.
He grimaced.
Now it seems that even Spax of the Gilk can revise his views. A time of miracles, to be sure. I will, I think, choose to see it this way. If nature must win in the end, then let the death of our kind be sweet and slow. So sweet, so slow that we do not even notice. Let us fade and dwindle in our tyranny. From world to continent, from continent to country, from country to city, city to neighborhood, to home, to the ground under our feet, and finally down to the pointless triumphs inside each of our skulls. These are not the words of a warrior.
He heard the harsh emotion in her tone and nodded in the darkness.
If it is true, and the grey helms seek to be the swords of nature's vengeance, then the shield anvil has missed the point. Since when is nature interested in revenge? Look around.
He waved a hand.
The grass grows back where it can. The birds nest where they can. The soil breathes when it can. It just goes on, Highness, the only way it knows how to. With what's left.
The same as us, she said.
Maybe this is what Krughava could see so clearly, and Tanakalian can't. When we war against nature, we war against ourselves. There is no distinction, no dividing line, no enemy. We devour everything in a lust for self-destruction, as if that is intelligence's only gift.
Only curse, you mean? He shrugged.
I suppose there is a gift in being able to see what we're doing even as we do it, and in seeing we come to understand.
Knowledge we choose not to use, Spex.
I have no answer to that, Firehair. Before our inaction, I am as helpless as the next man. But it may be that we all feel that way. Smart as we are individually, together we become stupid. Appallingly stupid.
He shrugged again.
Even the gods cannot find a way through this. And even if they had, we'd not listen, would we?
I see her face, Spex.
Her face, yes. It's not much of a face, is it? So plain, so lifeless.
Abrastol flinched. Find another word, please.
Bleak, then. But she makes no effort, does she? Nothing regal in her clothes. Not a single item of jewelry. No paint on her face or her lips, and her hair so short, so... Highness, why does any of that even bother me? But it does, and I don't know why.
Nothing regal, Abrastol mused. If what you say is true, and yes, so it seems to me as well, then why, when I look upon her, do I see, well, something?
That I did not see before, or that I did not understand. She ever grows in my mind, this adjunct Tavore. Noble, he said.
She gasped.
Yes. She doesn't fight against nature, does she?
Is it just that? Is that all it is? Spax shook his head.
Highness, you say you keep seeing her face. It is the same for me. I am haunted, and I do not know why. It floats behind my eyes, and I fix upon it again and again, as if I'm waiting. Waiting to see the expression it will assume. That one expression of truth. It's coming. I know it is. And so I look upon her, and I cannot stop looking upon her.
"She has made us all lost," Abrastel said. "I did not anticipate I would feel so troubled, Spax. It's not in my nature. Like some prophet of old, she has indeed led us out into the wilderness."
"Until she leads us home."
Abrastel turned and stepped closer, her eyes glittering.
"And will she?"
"In that nobility, Fireherr," he replied in a whisper, "I find faith against the despair, as did Krughava, and in the adjunct's small hand, like a wispy seed, there is compassion."
He watched her eyes widen, and then her hand was behind his head, pulling him close. One hard kiss, and then she pushed him away. "It's getting cold," she said, setting off for camp. Over a shoulder, she added, "You should be able to reach the Lethary before dawn." Spax stared after her.
"Very well. It seems we will do this after all. Hood, the Lord of Death, stood before me and spoke of fear, the fear of the dead. But if the dead know fear, what hope do we have? Tavore, does a god stand in your shadow, ready to offer us a gift for the sacrifices we will make? Is this your secret, the thing that takes away all your fear? Please, lean close and whisper it to me."
But that face there behind his eyes might have been as far away as the moon. And if the gods came at last to crowd round her, would they too look down in perilous wonder at that frail magic in the palm of her hand? Would it frighten them?
"When it so frightens the rest of us."
He looked out over the glass desert's offering of dead stars.
"Tavore, do you now shine bright among them, just one more of the fallen?
And would there come a time when her bones came crawling to this shore to join all the others?" Spax, war chief of the Gilk Bargast, shivered like a child left naked in the night, and the question pursued him as he set out for the Lethary camp. She had always considered the notion of penance to be pathetic self-indulgence, and those that set out upon such a course, choosing isolation and abnegation in some remote cave or weathered hut, were to her mind little more than cowards. The ethics of the world belonged to society, to that fraught maelstrom of relationships where argument and fierce emotions waged eternal war. Yet here she sat, alone beneath a green-limbed sky, with a slumbering horse her only company, and all her private arguments were slowly drifting away, as if she walked through one room after another, leaving ever further behind some regal chamber echoing with raucous debate. The irritation that was futility was finally gone, and in the silence ahead she sensed the gift of peace. Krughava snorted. Perhaps all those hermits and aesthetes were wiser than she had ever suspected. Tanakalian now stood in her place, there at the head of the Grey Helms, and he would lead them where he willed. She had been caught out by the logic of his argument, and, like a wolf brought to bay by hounds, she had found herself assailed as he closed in.
Contradiction.
In the rational realm, the word was a blistering condemnation. Proof of flawed logic. To expose it in an adversary's position was akin to delivering a death blow, and she well recalled the triumphant gleam in his eyes in the instant he struck. But, she wondered now, where was the crime in that most human of capacities, to carry in one's heart a contradiction, to leave it unchallenged, immune to reconciliation? Indeed, to be two people at once, each true to herself, and neither denying the presence of the other. What vast laws of cosmology were broken by this human talent? Did the universe split asunder? Did reality lose its way? No. In fact, it seemed that the only realm wherein contradiction had any power at all was the realm of rational argument. And, Krughava admitted, she had begun to doubt that realm's self-proclaimed virtue. Of course, Tanakalian would argue that her terrible crime had led the Perish Grey Helms into crisis. Upon whose side would they stand? How could they serve more than one master? Will we not fight for the wolves? Will we not fight for the wild? Or shall we commit sacrilege by kneeling before a mere mortal woman? This crisis, Krughava, is of your own making. Or words to that effect. Perhaps it was, at that, of her own making. And yet, within her there had been no conflict, no brewing storm awaiting them. She had chosen to walk at Tavare Paran's side. Together they had crossed half a world, and, Krughava had been certain, at the very end they would have remained side by side, two women against a raging conflagration. In that moment, success or failure would lose all relevance. The triumph was in the stance, in the defiance. Because this is the essence of life itself, human and wild. In that moment, we are all the same. Contradiction, Tanakalian? No, I would show you this final gift. Human and wild, we are the same. I would have shown the wolf gods the truth of this, whether they liked it or not. And this contradiction of yours, Shield Anvil, would have vanished like a puff of smoke. What did I seek in our faith? I sought to mend the impossible crisis that is our worship of the wild, our worship of all that we have left behind and to which we can never return. I sought reconciliation, an acceptance of the brutal contradiction of our human lives. But then the adjunct had rejected her. There was an old saying among the Perish that a room full of women was a knife seller's vision of paradise. There will be betrayal. Oh, yes, indeed, betrayal. So unexpected, so hurtful, that Tavare might as well have slit open Krughava's throat, watched her bleed out on the floor of the command tent. And now the mortal sword was lost. Contradiction. You would choose only the worthy to embrace, Shield Anvil? Then what you do is not an embrace, sir. It is a reward. And if you are to taste the flavor of naught but virtuous souls, how will you ever find the strength to best the flaws within your own soul? Shield Anvil Tanakalian, you are headed into difficult times. She sat alone, head lowered, her fur cloak drawn tight about her, weapons laid out to one side, hobbled horse behind her. Ranthervian, are you there, old friend? You refused his embrace. Your soul is left to wander where it will. Have you walked with me? Can you not hear my prayer? I was betrayed, and then betrayed a second time. If I am cruel, then your untimely death could mark the first of three, and all about me I see contradiction. You were the Destriant. From you comes the voice of our gods. But now the gods can tell us nothing, for you are silent. The Grey Helms are led by a Shield Anvil who has elected himself the sole arbiter of righteousness. I avowed service to the adjunct Tavare Paran, only to have her send me away. Nothing is as it seems. Her breath caught. Ice upon the surface of the lake seems solid, and we might slide quickly from place to place. But the ice is thin, and that is the danger, the price of carelessness. Did I not question the contradiction's criminality? She rose and faced the glass desert. Adjunct Tavare, she whispered, have I skidded too sure upon the ice? If I am untroubled by my own contradictions, why do I choose to see yours as a crime, as betrayal? That Gilk war chief, was it he who spoke of Tavare's surrender to despair, her expectation of failure, her desire to spare us the witnessing of that failure? Or was it all nothing more than what she said it was, a tactical necessity, Destriant, old friend, shall it be my own people who become the betrayers? Are we to be the knife that fatally strikes Tavore Paran and her Malazans? Run, Thervian, what must I do?
You could ride back to the camp, woman, and slide an arm's length of cold iron through the bastard.
She shook her head. The grey helms were bound to strict laws and would not permit themselves to be led by a murderer. No, they would execute her. But at least there would be no Tanakalian. Who would take command? Heveth? Lambat? But then, would they not feel bound to their last commander's intentions?
Listen to yourself, Krughava, actually considering outright murder of a fellow Grey Helm.
No, that was the wrong direction, the wrong path. She would have to leave the parish to whatever fate Tanakalian found for them. But the betrayal, well, that would not be set at her feet. Krughava faced the glass desert.
I will ride to her. I will warn her. And I will stand at her side until the very end.
All doubt vanished from her mind. She collected up her weapons.
See how clear the ice has become, Runthervian. I can see its thickness. Upon this, an entire army could march without fear.
Krughava drew a deep breath of cold night air and then turned to her horse.
Ah, friend, I have one thing left to ask of you.
The Vigath stood with their heads tilted downward, as if contemplating the lifeless earth at their feet, but Gessler knew it was simply the way they slept, or rather rested, since as far as he could tell, the huge reptilian warriors never closed their eyes. It was unnerving, leading an army like this.
Like commanding 10,000 hounds. But they're smarter than hounds, which makes it even worse.
The wings of Kel hunters remained well beyond the encampment, seemingly immune to the vicissitudes of food, water, and rest. Their endurance made him feel soft,
but not as soft as Stormy. Listen to that bastard snore. I can probably hear him over in the Lethary camp.
He knew he should be sleeping, but there had been dreams, unpleasant ones, disturbing enough to drag him out from his furs with dawn still two bells away. Now he stood looking upon the massed Vigath legions. They were halted in formation like vast assemblies of brooding statues, grey as dulled iron beneath the uncanny night sky. He had been kneeling as if broken, and the dreamscape surrounding him was a charnel house of torn bodies. The blood had soaked up through his leggings and now thickened against the skin of his knees and shins. Somewhere fire was pouring from the very bedrock and roiling gouts of deadly gases coiled skyward, and in that sky, as he'd looked up, he'd seen something. Clouds? He could not be sure, but there was something monstrous about them, something that ripped like talons into his chest. He'd seen motion, as if the sky itself was heaving.
A gate? Could be. But no gate could be as big as that. It took the whole sky. And why did it feel as if I was to blame for it?
Gessler might have cried out then, enough to rattle him awake. He'd lain beneath the firs, sweat-soaked and shivering. From the nearby ranks of Vigath came a stirring motion, as the flavors of his distress agitated the sleeping Kachain Chimal. Muttering under his breath, he'd risen to his feet. An army encamped without cook fires, without tents or roped pens or the ragged sprawl of followers. It didn't seem proper. In fact, it didn't seem real. The Wiccan cattle dog, Bent, had found him then. Misshapen snout, one clouded eye, the gleam of canines and splintered teeth. He'd never seen so many scars on a single animal. But as the beast drew up, Gessler remembered back to a late afternoon on the Aran Way.
Hunting survivors. And how pathetic was that? Two damned dogs. Among so many corpses, the memory haunts me to this day. Two damned dogs. And then that Trell there on the wagon. All of us on the bed. Me, Stormy, Truth, and that Trell.
willing two dying animals back to life. Truth, he was weeping. But we knew what it was all about. We knew it because we felt it. So many had been taken from us that day. Coltane, Bolt, Lull. Dyker, gods, finding him crucified like that, at the road's end, staked to the last of those ghastly trees. No, we couldn't tell truth about that. It's what made the name we'd given him sting us so afterwards. We kept it from him, me and Stormy. But that Trell saw through us and was good enough to say nothing. We saved the lives of two dumb dogs, and it was like a new dawn. He looked down at Bent. Remember that day, you ugly horror?
The wide head lifted, the motions stretching the torn lips back from the crooked teeth, the misaligned jaw that should have made the dog look comical, but didn't. No, instead, it broke the heart.
All you did in our name. Too loyal for your own good. Too brave to know any different. And still you failed to protect them. Would you have been happier if we'd let you die? Freed your spirits to run with the ones you loved? Did we hurt you that day? Me and Stormy and Truth and that Trell? I hear you, he whispered, studying the dog. The way you wince when you get up after another night on cold ground. I see you limping at day's end, Bent. You and me, we're both breaking down. This journey will be the last of us, won't it? You and me, Bent, the last of us. I'll take your side when the time comes, he said. In fact, I will die for you, dog. It's the least I can do.
The promise sounded foolish, and he looked round to make certain no one else was near. Their only company was the other dog, Roach, digging frantically at some mouse hole. Gessler sighed.
But who says my life's worth any more than this dog's, or that its life is worth less than mine? Who stands around measuring these things? The gods? Ah, good one. No, we do, and that's the sorriest joke of all.
Feeling chilled, he shook himself. Bent sat down on his left, yawned with a grinding, grating sound. Gessler grunted.
We've seen a lot, ain't we? All that grey in our muzzles, hey? Aran Way. The sun was hot, but we could barely feel it. Truth brushing the flies from the wounds. We don't like death. It's as simple as that. We don't like it.
He heard soft footpads and turned to see Destriant Kallith approaching. When she settled down on Bent's other side and rested a hand on the beast's head, Gessler flinched, but the dog did not move. He grunted.
Never seen Bent accept that from anybody, Destriant.
South of the Glass Desert, she said, we are soon to enter the homeland of my people. Not my tribes, but our kin. The Elan lived on the plains that enclosed the Glass Desert on three sides. My own clan was to the north.
Then you can't be certain they're all dead, these ones in the south.
She shook her head.
I am. The Voice Slayers from Colance hunted down the last of us. Those that didn't die from the drought, I mean.
Kallith, if you got away, others did too.
I hope not,
she whispered, and she set to massaging the cattle dog, along the shoulders, down the length of the beast's back to the hips, and under her breath she chanted something in her own language. Bent's eyes slowly closed. Gessler watched her, wondering at the meaning of her reply. Whispered like a prayer.
It seems, he muttered after a moment, that us survivors all share the same torment.
She glanced up at him.
That is why you and the Shield Anvil always argue. It's like watching your children die, isn't it?
A clutch of pain inside made him look away.
I don't know why the adjunct wants it this way, but I do know why she's keeping it all inside. She has no choice. Maybe none of us do. We are what we are, and no amount of talking or explaining is going to make a difference to anything.
Bent was lying down now, breathing slow in sleep. Kallith slowly withdrew her hands.
You just took away his pain, didn't you?
She shrugged. My people kept such animals. As children, we all learned the songs of peace.
Songs of peace, Gessler mused. It'd be nice to hear a few more of those in the world, wouldn't it?
Not any time soon, I fear.
They just found you, didn't they, in their search for people to lead them?
She nodded, straightening. It wasn't fair, but I'm glad of it, Mortal Sword.
She faced him.
I am, and I am glad of you, and Stormy, and these dogs, even Grub.
But not Sin. No one is glad of Sin. Poor girl, she probably knows it too. Sin lost her brother, he said, but she might have been unhinged long before that. She was caught in a rebellion.
He glanced down at Bent.
No one came through it unscarred.
As you said, the curse of surviving.
Making us no different from the Kachain Jamal, he observed. I'm surprised it took them so long to realize it.
Gant's Mac's mother realized it, and for that she was deemed insane. If we do not fight together, we end up fighting each other. She died before she could witness the fruits of her vision. She died believing she had failed.
Kallus, the winged assassin, Gurul, does it remain guarding us?
She looked skyward, eyes narrowing at the jade strangers.
I sent the Shigal to scout our approach.
Into Kollance? Isn't that risky?
She shrugged.
In truth, Gurul serves Gunt's Mac. It is by her command that she releases him to us. This time, however, the matron and I agreed. Mortal Sword, from the visions Gurul has given me, I do not think the Grey Helms accept your command.
Gessler snorted.
Pious boars! I'm glad of that, truth be told. Oh, Krukhava looked to be capable and all that. But I tell you, all that wolf-worshipping made me uneasy.
Noting her raised brow, he shrugged and said,
I went and picked my own god of war, so it's a bit much to be going on about the perish. The thing is, Kallus, it makes sense for a soldier to choose a god of war. It doesn't make sense when a god of war makes soldiers of an entire people. It's the wrong way round, right? Well, there's something skewed about it, though I can't really tell you why I feel that way.
So they are free to do as they please?
I suppose so. I don't know much about this Tanakalian, except that he'd have done well in the Malazan court, if there's any truth to the story of how he usurped Krugava. People like that, Kallus, I don't trust. It's what got me in so much trouble all those years ago. Anyway, if Tanakalian wants to take his perish right up the arsehole of the Forkral Asael, well, he's welcome to light his own torch and go to it.
What are your thoughts on the Lethary Prince, Mortal Sword?
Him I like. Aranict, too. Solid people, those two. From what I heard back in Lethary, before his brother took the throne, Bryce was some kind of special bodyguard to the Lethary Emperor. Unmatched with a sword. That tells me more about him than you think.
In what way?
Anyone who has mastered a weapon, truly mastered it, is a humble man or woman. More than that, I know how he thinks and something of what he sees, the way his brain works. And it seems that making him a prince hasn't changed him any. So, Kallus, worry not about the Lethary. Come the day, they'll be there.
Leaving only the Balkando.
She defers to Bryce, I think. She doesn't want to, but that's just how it is. Besides, Gessler added, she has red hair.
Kallus frowned.
I don't understand.
Me and Stormy were Falari. Plenty of red-haired people in Falar. So, I'll tell you what a Brastel is like. Deadly temper, glowing hot iron. But being a mother, she's learned the wisdom of knowing what's in her control and what isn't. She doesn't like it, but she lives with it. Likes her sex, too, but prone to jealousy. And all of that bluster, why, it's all for show. Inside, she's just looking for a man like me. She gasped.
But she's married, and to a king.
Gessler grinned. Was just seeing if you were still listening, Destriant. Saw your attention drifting there.
A hunter found me. You're closed off and Stormy is sleeping. A rider was seen, out from close to the Perish camp, riding into the glass desert.
Any more detail than that?
You can see what the hunter saw, Mortal Sword.
Right, I can, can't I?
He concentrated for a moment and then swore under his breath.
Krughava.
Where?
To the adjunct, I'd wager. But she'll never make it.
What should we do?
Gessler scratched his jaw and then wheeled round.
Stormy, wake up, you fat bearded ox!
Book 5. A Hand Upon the Fates. I have had visions of the future, and each and every one of them ends up in the same place. Don't ask me what it means. I already know. That's the problem with visions of the future. Emperor Kellenved. Chapter 14. Where is the meaning in this stride, foot following foot? Why must the land crawl so beneath us in our journey? All to take us to the place where we began so long ago, only to find it strange and unknown and unredeemed. Who has blazed this trail, and how weary must I become before the rain grows gentle and soft as tears on the brow? Until the valley unfolds into a river the sweet color of sand, and trees ribbon the sky overhead with dusty leaves. How weary must you become as you rattle the chains and drown in the banners of meaning and rueful portent? If I make you share my torment, foot following foot, know that this is my curse of the swallowed key and cruel desire, and when our blood mixes and drains in the grey earth, when the faces blur before our eyes in these last of last days, we shall turn about to see the path of years we have made, and wail at the absence of answers and the things left unseen. For this is life's legion of truth, so strange, so unknown, so unredeemed, and we cannot know what we will live until the journey is done. My beautiful legion, leave me to rest on the wayside as onward you march to the circling sun, where spin shadows tracing the eternal day. Raise stones to signal my passing, unmarked and mysterious, saying nothing of me, saying nothing at all. The legion is faceless and must ever remain so, as faceless as the sky. Skull's Lament, Anamandaris, Fisher Kel'Tath. White as bone, the butterflies formed a vast cloud overhead. Again and again their swirling mass dimmed the sun with a blessed gift of shadow that moments later broke apart, proving that curses hid in every gift, and that blessings could pass in the blink of an eye. An eye swarming with flies. Badal could feel and indeed see them clustering at the corners. She could feel them drinking her tears. She did not resent their need, and their frenzied crawl and buzz felt cool against her scorched cheeks. Those that crowded her mouth she ate when she could, the taste bitter when she crushed them, the wings like patches of dry skin, almost impossible to swallow. Since the shards had left, only the butterflies and the flies remained, and there was something pure in these last two forces. One white, the other black. Only the extremes remained. From the unyielding ground below to the hollow sky above, from the push of life to the pull of death, from the breath hiding within to the last to leave a fallen child. The flies fed upon the living, but the butterflies waited for the dead. There was nothing in between, nothing but this walking, the torn feet and the stains they left behind, the figures toppling and then stepped over.
In her head, Badal was singing. She sensed the presence of others, not those ahead of her or those behind her, but ghostly things, invisible eyes and veiled thoughts, an impatience, a harsh desire for judgment, as if the snake's very existence was an affront, to be ignored, denied, fled from. But she would not permit any to escape. They did not have to like what they saw. They did not have to like her at all, or Rut, or Held, or Sadik, or any of the bare thousand still alive. They could rail at her thoughts, at the poetry she found in the heart of suffering, as if it had no meaning to them, no value, no truth. They could do all of that. Still, she would not let them go.
"I am as true as anything you have ever seen, a dying child abandoned by the world. And I say this, there is nothing truer, nothing. Flee from me if you can. I promise I will haunt you. This is my only purpose now, the only one left to me. I am history made alive, holding on but failing. I am everything you would not think of, belly filled and thirst slaked. There in all your comforts, surrounded by faces you know and love. But hear me, heed my warning, history has claws."
Sadik still carried his hoard. He dragged it behind him, in a sack made of clothes no longer needed by anyone. His treasure trove, his things. What did he want with them? What meaning hid inside that sack? All those stupid bits, the shiny stones, the pieces of wood. And the way, with every dusk, when they could walk no further, he would take them all out to look at them. Why did that frighten her? Sometimes he would weep for no reason, and make fists as if to crush all his baubles into dust, and it was then that she realized that Sadik didn't know what they meant either. But he wouldn't leave them behind. That sack would be the death of him. She imagined the moment when he fell, this boy she would have liked for a brother, onto his knees, hands all entwined in the cloth sleeves, falling forward so that his face struck the ground. He'd tried to get back up, but he'd fail, and the flies would swarm him until he was no longer even visible, just a seething, glittering blackness, where Sadik had been. They'd eat his last breath, drink the last tears from his eyes, which now just stared, invade his open mouth to make it dry as a cave, a spider hole. And then the swarm would explode, rush away, seeking more of life's sweet water. And down would descend the butterflies, to strip away his skin, and the thing left, with its sack, would no longer be Sadik.
"Sadik will be gone. Happy Sadik. Peaceful Sadik, a ghost hovering, looking down at that sack. I would have words for him, for his passing. I would stand over him, looking down at all those fluttering wings so like leaves, and I would try, one more time, to make sense of the sack that killed him. And I would fail, making my words few, weak, a song of unknowing. All I have for my brother Sadik. When that time comes, I will know it is time for me to die too. When that time comes, I will give up."
And so she sang, a song of knowing, the most powerful song of all. They had a day left, maybe two.
"Is this what I wanted? Every journey must end. Out here there is nothing but ends. No beginnings left. Out here, I have nothing but claws." "Badal."
The word was soft, like crumpled cloth, and she felt it brush her senses.
"Rut. I can't do this anymore." "But you are Rut, the head of the snake, and Held, who is the tongue." "No, I can't. I have gone blind."
She moved up alongside him, studied his old man's face.
"They're swollen," she said. "Closed up, Rut. It's to keep them safe, your eyes." "But I can't see." There's nothing to see, Rut. I can't lead. For this, there is no one better. But Al, even the stones are gone. Just walk, Rut. The way is clear. For as far as I can see, it's clear.
He loosed a sob. The flies poured in, and he bent over, coughing, retching. He stumbled, and she caught him before he fell. Rut righted himself, clutching held tight. Badal heard a soft whimper rising from them both.
No water. This is what is killing us now.
Squinting, she glanced back. Sadik was nowhere in sight. Had he already fallen? If he had, it would be just as well that she'd not seen it. Other faces, vaguely familiar, stared at her and Rut, waiting for the snake to begin moving once again. They stood hunched over, tottering. They stood with backs arched and bellies distended as if about to drop a baby. Their eyes were depthless pools where the flies gathered to drink. Sores crusted their noses, their mouths and ears. Skin on cheeks and chins had cracked open and glistened beneath ribbons of flies. Many were bald, missing teeth, their gums bleeding, and Rut was not alone in being blind.
Our children, see what we have done to them. Our mothers and fathers left us to this, and now we leave them too in our turn. There is no end to the generations of the foolish. One after another, and at some point we all started nodding, thinking this is how it has to be, and so we don't even try to change things. All we pass down to our children is the same stupid grin. But I have claws, and I will tear away that grin. I swear it. Badal.
She had begun singing out loud, wordless, the tone low and then building, thickening, until she could feel more than one voice within her, and each in turn joined her song, filling the air. Their sound was one of horror, a terrible thing. She felt its power growing, growing.
Adal, I have claws, I have claws, I have claws. Show me that grin one more time. Show it, I'm begging you. Let me tear it from your face. Let me rip deep until my talons score your teeth. Let me feel the blood and let me hear the meat splitting. And let me see the look in your eyes as you meet mine. Let me see I have claws, I have claws, I have claws. Badal!
Someone struck her, knocked her down. Stunned, she stared up into Sadik's face, his round, wizened face. And from his eyes, red tears tracked down through the dust on his leathery cheeks.
Don't cry. She whispered. It's all right, Sadik. Don't cry.
Rut knelt beside her, groped with one hand until his fingers brushed her forehead.
What have you done?
His tone startled her.
The cloth is torn. They're all too weak, she said. Too weak to feel anger. So I felt it for them, for all of you.
She stopped. Rut's fingertips leaked blood. She could feel crystal shards digging into her back.
What? You moved us,
Sadik said.
It hurt.
She could hear wailing now. The snake was writhing in pain.
I went looking. For what?
Rut demanded.
For what? For claws.
Sadik shook his head.
Badal, we're children. We don't have claws.
The sun dimmed then, and she squinted past Sadik, but the butterflies were gone.
Flies, look at all the flies. We don't have claws, Badal. No, Sadik, you're right, we don't. But someone does.
The power of the song still clung to her, fierce as a promise.
Someone does. I'm taking us there, she said, meeting Sadik's wide eyes.
He drew back, leaving her to stare up at the sky. Flies roiling in a massive cloud, black as the abyss. She clambered to her feet.
Take my hand, Rut. It's time to walk.
she crouched, staring up at the gate. Beneath it, the crumbling ruin of Kettle House was like a thing crushed under a heel. Something like blood oozed out from its roots to carve runnels down the slope. She believed it was dead, but of course there was no way to know for sure. There was no glory in failure. Killava had learned that long, long ago. The passing of an age was always one of dissolution, a final sigh of exhaustion and surrender. She had seen her kin vanish from the world. The venal mockery that were the T'lani Mas hardly weighed as much as dust upon the scales of survival, and she well understood the secret desires of Olar Ithil. Maybe the hag would succeed. The spirits knew she was ripe for redemption. Killava had lied to Onrak, to Udinas, to Ulshun Pral and his clan. There had been no choice. To remain here would have seen them all slain, and she would not have that on her conscience. When the wound was breached, the Elaint would enter this world. There was no hope of stopping them. Tiam could not be denied, not with what was coming. The only unknown to her mind was the crippled god. The Forkrel Asael was simple enough, as bound to the insanity of final arguments as were the Tist Leosan. Kin in spirit, those two. And she believed she knew what her brother intended to do, and she would leave him to it. And if her blessing meant anything, well, then he had it, with all her heart. No, the crippled god was the only force that troubled her. She remembered the earth's pain when he was brought down from the sky. She remembered his fury and his agony when first he was chained. But the gods were hardly done with him. They returned again and again, crushing him down, destroying his every attempt to find a place for himself. If he cried out for justice, no one was interested in listening. If he howled in wretched suffering, they but turned away. But the crippled god was not alone in that neglect. The mortal realm was crowded with those who were just as wounded, just as broken, just as forgotten. In this way, all that he had become, his very place in the pantheon, had been forged by the gods themselves. And now they feared him. Now they meant to kill him.
"Because the gods will not answer mortal suffering. It is too much work."
He must know what they intended. She was certain of it. He must be desperate in seeking a way out, an escape. No matter what, she knew he would not die without a fight. Was this not the meaning of suffering? Her feline eyes narrowed on the gate. Starvald Demolane was a fiery red welt in the sky, growing, deepening.
"Soon," she whispered.
She would flee before them. To remain here was too dangerous. The destruction they would bring to this world would beggar the dreams of even the Forkrel Asael. And once upon the mortal realm, so crowded with pathetic humans, there would be slaughter on a colossal scale. Who could oppose them? She smiled at the thought.
"There are a few, aren't there? But too few. No, friends, let them loose. Tiam must be reborn to face her most ancient enemy. Chaos against order, as simple, as banal as that. Do not stand in their path. Not one of you could hope to survive it."
What then of her children?
"Dear brother, let us see, shall we? The hag's heart is broken, and she will do whatever she can to see it healed. Despise her on us. The spirits know she deserves nothing else, but do not dismiss her. Do not."
It seemed very complicated. Killava Onas looked up at the wound.
"But it isn't. It isn't anything like that at all."
Rock cracked in Kettle House, startling her. Reddish mists roiled out from the sundered walls.
"She was flawed, was Kettle. Too weak, too young."
What legacy could be found in a child left alone, abandoned to the fates? How many truths hid in the scatter of small bones? Too many to bear thinking about. Another stone shattered, the sound like snapping chains. Killava returned her attention to the gate.
Gruntle slumped against a massive boulder in the full sun and leaned his head back against the warm stone, closing his eyes.
Instinct's a bitch.
The god who had damned him was a burning presence deep inside, filling him with an urgency he could not understand. His nerves were frayed. He was exhausted. He had journeyed through countless realms, desperate to find the quickest path to take him where?
A gate. A disaster about to be unleashed. What is it you so fear, Trake? Why can you not just tell me, you miserable rat-chewing bastard? Show me an enemy. Show me someone I can kill for you, since that seems to be the only thing that pleases you.
The air stank. He listened to the flies crawling on the corpses surrounding him. He didn't know where he was. Broad-leafed trees encircled the glade. He had heard geese flying overhead, but this was not his world. It felt different, like a place twisted by sickness, and not the sickness that had taken the 20 or so wretched humans lying here in the high grasses, marring their skin with weeping pustules, swelling their throats and forcing their tongues past blistered lips. No, all of that was just a symptom of some deeper disease.
There was intention here. Someone summoned Polyel and set her upon these people. I am being shown true evil. Is that what you wanted, Trake? Reminding me of just how horrifying we can be. People curse you, and the pestilence of your touch ruins countless lives. But you are not a stranger to any world. These people, someone used you to kill them.
He thought he'd seen the worst of humanity's flaws back in Capustan, in the Panion War, an entire people deliberately driven insane. But if he understood the truths behind that war, there had been a wounded thing at the very core of the domain, a thing that could only lash out, claws bared, so vast, so consuming was its pain. And though he was not yet ready for it, a part of him understood that forgiveness was possible. From the streets of Capustan to the throne in Coral, and probably beyond, there had been mention of a being trapped in a gate, sealing a wound with its own life force. He could track an argument through all that, and the knowledge gave him something close to peace, enough to live with.
But not here. What crime did they commit, these poor people, to earn such punishment?
He could feel his tears drying on his cheeks.
This is unforgivable. Is it my anger you want, Trake? Is this why I am here, to be reawakened? Enough of the shame, the grief, the self-recrimination. Is that what you're telling me? Well then, it hasn't worked. All I see here is what we're capable of doing.
He missed Ganos Paran and Itkovian, friends to whom he could speak. They seemed to belong to a different life, a life long lost to him.
Harlo. Ah, you should see your namesake, my friend. Oh, how you would have loved him. She'd have to fight you off, brick up the doors to keep you from being his father. You'd have shown her what it meant to love a child unconditionally. Stoney, do you miss Harlow as much as I do? But you've got the boy, you've got your son, and I promised I would come back. I promised. What would you do here, Master of the Deck?
His question was swallowed by the glade.
What choice would you make, Paran? We weren't happy with our lots, were we? But we took hold of them anyway. By the throat. I expect you've yet to relinquish your grip. Me? Ah, gods, how I've messed it up.
In his dreams he had seen a blackened thing, with claws of red and fangs dripping gore, lying panting, dying, on churned-up earth. The air was brittle cold.